They have published some of the most well-known authors in the Southern movement, from the Kennedy brothers to Jimmy Cantrell. Pelican Publishing Company has an incredibly diverse library of over 1,300 titles to their credit, with about 60 new titles published annually. If you like books about history, literature, humor, Cajun cooking, travel, or just about anything else, Pelican's website, ePelican.com, is the place for you. With online catalogs and secure online shopping, it's never been easier to tap into the wealth of knowledge and reading pleasure that Pelican has to offer. At ePelican.com, you can browse all of the Pelican's titles and shop for just the right book for yourself or a gift for someone else. Treat yourself today. Visit ePelican.com. That website again, ePelican.com.
All right, welcome to a live program here at Dixie Broadcasting. You're in for a treat if you're listening to the radio station this morning. I know that many of you are tuned in to hear Ron Wilson's Straight Talk program, and it will air immediately after this program. But we've got a real special treat for you this morning. We have a special episode of the Pelican Pages segments that we do. Typically, we do those on Wednesday evening, but we're going to do one this morning with an author that we've had on the program before. And she's a great author and a tremendous new book that she has published by Pelican Publishing Company. It's entitled Immortal Captives, and the author is Muriel Jocelyn. And Muriel, thank you for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, Muriel, I know from us having talked before that you're a native of right here in Georgia where we are, and you've been involved in the things to do with the war for quite a while. I think you were a founding member of the Civil War Roundtable here in Georgia, weren't you?
No. At Virginia Tech.
Oh, okay, at Virginia Tech. Okay. And you still live here in Georgia, and so we're just glad to be able to call you a Georgian.
So, well, it's my heritage, so.
Well, if you would, I guess for those who may not have heard the original interview that we did with you on your book entitled Confederate Women, tell us a little bit about yourself as far as growing up, how you became interested in Southern things in general.
Probably like most Southern kids that grew up in the early 60s, it was the centennial years. And I think the war was brought into the forefront with, you know, all the Disney movies and some television shows, The Rebel, and a lot of Hollywood movies did a lot of the theme with Civil War and family stories. So that kind of emphasized it at a very early age for me. And I was just fascinated by it always. So as I got older, even as a teenager and went to college, I just read and read and read everything I could and learned a lot about it. And the love for it just really stayed with me.
Well, and that shows, obviously, in your writing as well. Now, we've talked about your book that you had published by Pelican entitled Confederate Women. This book is a totally different topic, although it's still related to the war. It's entitled Immortal Captives. Now, if you would, tell our listeners exactly who these folks are, these immortal captives, and how did you become interested in this topic in particular?
The title refers to a group of Confederate officers who became known after the war amongst themselves as the Immortal 600. They were specifically targeted, chosen from Fort Delaware as a hand-picked group of 600 officers for the Union to use in retaliation for the way they perceived that their prisoners were being treated in the South. But they took it several steps further. But at any rate, it's about this specific group of 600 men from all 14 southern states, even the border states, and their captivity of about 9 months. They started out at Fort Delaware, they went to Hilton Head Island, they ended up at Fort Pulaski, and then back to Fort Delaware between August of 1864 and March of 1865. And it's quite an odyssey for them. So it's really just this group of men and their captivity.
And when you say that the Yankees took it a step further in the retaliation using these Confederate POWs, that's a very mild way of putting it, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, Folks, we're talking to Muriel Jocelyn about her brand new book from Pelican Publishing entitled Immortal Captives. And while we're actually on the broadcast, you can even go and take a look at this book on the Pelican website by going to epelican.com. And there's a little tab at the top of that website. It says Browse. If you'll click on the Browse button, you can actually do a search and find this exact book either by typing in Muriel's name, Muriel Jocelyn, or by putting in the title of the book, Immortal Captives. And it'll pull the book up for you there, give you a short review of it online, and you can actually purchase it at a reduced price from the Pelican website. And now, Muriel, I have to tell you that I have heard a number of men in Southern Heritage circles say before, and to some degree I have agreed that for the most part, when ladies usually are writing about the emotional ties that existed between different people during the war, they usually do a better job than men. But when it comes to the details of the battles and the political goings on, usually ladies don't do that as well as men do. But I have to tell you, I have never in all of my years as a history professor or as just a self-taught student of history, have I found a book by man or woman, either one, that went into as great a precise detail about these the rules of exchange and the rules in which the prisoners were to be treated, and lays out the exact situation in which these men found themselves. So you certainly have broken that stereotype wide open.
Well, great. And it really is fascinating. When I started working on the story, all I had was really a little bit. I knew there was a group called the Immortal 600. I had seen a very small article, and it captivated me. I wanted to understand, how did these men get in this predicament?
Right.
And like everything, you can't just take a chunk of the experience. You have to set it up. So in order to understand how their experience was so horrible, you had to understand what the policy was and how the Yankees really broke their own policy. But then you have to understand all of the ages of prisoner of war, the laws of war, and how it boiled down to their time and how they just had, they butchered the rules. So in order to understand their experience, you had to go back to what the ransom situation was in the Dark Ages with the knights in medieval times, and how the POWs were treated up into modern times. And when you take their experience out of that range of time from 1400 to World War II, it is just the most extreme. It is just the worst treatment on record in history for any country. So that's why I put all the background in there, so people could read for themselves and see for themselves how it compared.
Well, I have to tell you that although I had a little bit of an understanding about those rules for prisoners of war up into the modern era, and somewhat of an idea of the rules of exchange that existed during the War of Northern Aggression, I really had nowhere near the exact precise concepts that you laid out in the book, and obviously it must have taken a tremendous amount of research to be able to pull out and put together all of those different parts to the rules that were established during the war and prior to the war, as well as the accounts of the men that were participating in that process.
Exactly. And to make it clear to the reader, I had to figure out, okay, how can I make this understandable? Because it's a lot of technical legalese,
right,
when you look at it. And so that's why I tried to simplify it, and I gave plenty of footnote sources if people really want to go and look at the technical lawyerism about it.
Yeah, and
I found it just really fascinating how the laws of war had been set up. It was just such a code of honor. It really was from the age of chivalry, and it fell apart completely in 1861.
Well, it's obvious that even though it was written by a lot of attorneys and bureaucrats, you've definitely laid it out in a very clear, concise manner that anyone who's really interested can read it and completely understand exactly what was going on at the time. Now, I know we don't want to give away the all the little nuggets from the book, but do you want to just recount briefly exactly what the story was of these men and how it came to happen that they were used as a human shield?
It sort of starts with Andersonville, and most people that hear Andersonville, they think of this prison that had been there for 4 years. Andersonville had only been there 6 months when it was pretty much emptied in 1864, late 64. But that was what sparked the whole thing. There was a group of Andersonville prisoners that were moved to Savannah. The Confederates trying to alleviate the conditions at Andersonville. And some of them were sent to Charleston, and they were put in a house in the civilian sections where the hospitals were, what was considered the safe area, if any place was, because Charleston was being shelled. And the Union general in the harbor, General John Foster, said they were technically under fire. So he's using the law here, the laws of war. You can't locate POWs under fire.
Right.
And that started the whole tit-for-tat thing about, okay, well then, you know, if you're going to shoot at us, we're going to shoot at you, and this sort of thing. They ended up under Confederate fire as well, because the 600 did, because the Union put the Immortal 600 on an island under Confederate fire from Fort Moultrie.
Right.
So they were technically under both sides fire. The shells went over both of them. And the stories that the men wrote in their diaries are amazing.
Well, it's interesting to point out that, first of all, the reason that the prisoners were moved out of Andersonville in the first place was because Sherman's army, as you pointed out, was coming south, and they really didn't have a choice. They had to move the POWs, and there were fewer and fewer pockets of territory still under the control of the Confederacy at that point. So Charleston and Savannah were two of the last remaining places to move them.
Yeah, I mean, they really, when you look at the Confederate idea of what to do, it was their only option. And there was a peace delegation sent, not really a peace delegation, but a group sent from Andersonville, Union soldiers, to Lincoln to plead for, you know, bring back the exchange policy. That was the big problem, why there were so many prisoners. The Union would not honor the exchange policy, and the South wanted to. So, it, you know, it essentially set up a system that would fail and then blamed the South.
Well, I don't
know. You know, and all of this is not usually stuff that you find spelled out in the book.
That's
it's
right.
It's really sort of a swept under the carpet story. But what really, really grabbed me and what I really enjoyed the most was just learning about the men through their diaries and letters. And they were wonderful writers for the most part, so they paint very vivid pictures. And I used as many excerpts as I could. And why should I tell it in my words when their words are so much better? So there's a lot of really good diary accounts that not only give you insight into their experience, but into the type of men that made up the army. There was a lot of diversity. And so I just learned a lot from this book myself, things I had never read anywhere else. So it was fun. It was a fun project. And I met a lot of descendants.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm.
Are they still living, I guess, in the same general places that their families were originally from? Or?
Yeah, it was really crazy because I thought, how can I find descendants? And there was a list of the men made by one of them in prison, and he got all their names, he got all their hometowns, got their regiments. I thought, well, you know, there's no place else to start, so I looked at all the towns on the list, I wrote to their libraries in those towns, and the librarians, bless their hearts, so many of them recognized the last names from somebody in town that they passed it along.
Wow.
And it turned out in a lot of cases those were descendants.
How about that?
So I turned up pictures, a few more diaries. One of the fascinating things was the men themselves passed around autograph books and got each other's autographs, and they would write. It was like a senior class yearbook. They would write little things about each other, you know.
Oh.
It was just really a fascinating social study as well about how this group of men interacted.
Well, that's amazing. Now, I know that the Yankees were charging that the Confederates were intentionally holding the Yankee POWs there in Charleston in the way of fire, and yet, like you said, the Confederates had actually put the Yankee POWs in the safest part of Charleston, and had already explained to the Yankee commanders that that was the civilian portion of the town, and it was the Yankee commander that continued to bombard, even knowing that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was all a setup, you know. And even the Union prisoners, and they were all officers, too. That's why Confederate officers were chosen. It was supposed to be a let's pick the same thing and do the same thing. But a lot of the Union officers wrote in their diaries their diets. They were being very well fed. They were not worried one bit. They felt like the shelling was nowhere close.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get this totally different picture, and their diaries are in the book, too, of what they perceive and what the Union general is trying to make everybody else perceive.
Now throughout the episode of the Confederate officers being used as a human shield, without giving away too much, can you tell us how many of those men died in that process or just in the prisons themselves over the course of the next few months?
Talking about the Union?
No, I'm sorry, the Confederate officers.
I don't have my book. I believe there were close to 40 deaths. I don't remember the exact number out of 600.
And those were directly related to the
Yankees? Oh, yeah, they died in prison from starvation.
Wow. And this was at a time, of course, when although people all over the South in the Confederacy might not have had food, the Yankee Army certainly had plenty of food and supplies that they could have provided had they chosen to. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole thing, retaliation. It's like, well, you can't feed our soldiers. We choose not to feed yours. That was their way of thinking.
And isn't it amazing, Muriel, we have all these books and movies that have come out about Andersonville portraying it and Captain Wirtz in such an awful light, when they really had nothing that they could do to help the Yankee soldiers because their own government wouldn't take them back in
right.
exchange. And yet,
and even the Confederate commanders in the South, in the Department of the South, contacted the Union occupation troops in Florida that had already taken the coast,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to send the Andersonville prisoners to them. They said, please just take them. Even if you won't exchange our men, take your men. They wouldn't.
Wow.
They turned down that offer. So, you know, there's a whole lot going on that people
uh-huh.
don't know anything about. And I've got all this documented. I mean, like I said, I learned a lot when I started digging and finding records and Union accounts, and went to the National Archives and looked at the Army records that have never been published anyplace. So it's a real eye-opener, let's put it that way. And it's a fascinating story about a group of incredible men.
Who really had created their own, they viewed each other as brothers in that situation.
Yeah. They were in a bond for life. I even followed some of them on after the war. All the way up till their death, they were in contact with a lot of the men they were in prison with.
Well, it certainly should be eye-opening to many folks who read the book and learn much of this information for the first time, that the Lincoln administration in particular and the Yankee government in Washington in general really had a totally different view and value of human life than existed in the South then or now, I believe.
I think it was a we've got to win at any cost and we will do whatever it takes mentality.
I'm afraid that sounds startling familiar to things that come out of Washington in our day and time.
Yeah, you know, it was very modern.
And
it was shocking at the time, but it's very modern.
And you know, we make no bones about it here at Dixie Broadcasting. We're pro-Southern and not politically correct, but you know, it seems like it's always Southern boys that end up being the majority of the cannon fodder wherever the Yankee Army goes.
Mm-hmm. In every war, even up to this day, yeah.
Well, tell us, were you able to research any of the fate of the survivors after the war was over, those who actually made it through?
I traced them all the way through. And I also had a biographical roster that was published before, but Pelican didn't republish it. That it's because it's more of interest to genealogy people. But
right.
It's a paragraph on each man with all of his personal statistics, service record, post-war you know, information I got from the census and the families and where he's
sure.
buried.
Well, I have to tell you, Muriel, I still have a little bit left to finish the book because I just haven't been able to get all the way to the end yet, but it has been one of the most fascinating books that I have read in a long time. Very enjoyable reading. And I just appreciate you putting this information together, that even information that even an old history teacher didn't know before.
I get that all the time. I get Civil War buffs that think they've read it all, and this one's got new stuff.
It definitely
but
does.
That, you know, it was just the story. Most people are not interested in prisoners. They're not the action. They're mm-hmm. not the battlefield. They're battlefield casualties in a different way. And a more passive way. And I guess it just doesn't grab the imagination, but, you know, it's the story of people, and that's what fascinated me.
Well, your book definitely breaks that stereotype, too, Muriel. It's a great book and a fascinating read. Now, do you want to say anything about the fate of those immortal 600 that are still lying in unmarked graves there in Savannah today?
Well, we know where the cemetery is. I was present for an archaeological dig, and the problem is the cemetery doesn't have just them in it. It has civilians from the military post that was there all the way into the 20th century.
Okay.
And there's no way to distinguish who's in which grave.
Okay.
So, you know, we know they're there. We've got the list. We've gone in the ground to an extent. And, you know, I don't know what the future will be. Maybe mm-hmm. one day we can at least have a list of them, but they have marked it with an interpretive marker.
Well, you know, about 2 weeks ago, I was there at Fort Pulaski. I've visited there many different times growing up since I was a little boy, and my mom and dad took us there. And for the first time, when I visited a couple of weeks ago, they were actually flying above the fort, the first national flag, the Stars
yeah,
and Bars.
They do sometimes.
And they said they have actually begun doing that several times a week now.
Great.
And so that was a tremendous blessing to see that flying over the fort of our heroes there in
Savannah. Fort Pulaski was the first place I went for my research because I really did not know where to start. And that was the only place that still existed where they had been held, except for Fort Delaware. But they were held at Fort Pulaski for so long.
Right.
And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And they have always been supportive. So I got, you know, Fort Pulaski's got a special little place in my heart. So.
Well, we told the Rangers there we appreciated them flying the good guys flag, and they got a chuckle out of that. So.
Yeah, I'm going down there for a book signing, actually, on May, whatever the day, I guess May 24th is Memorial Day weekend. That Saturday,
okay.
I'll be in Savannah at Fort Pulaski.
Great, great. Now, I know we've already talked about this when we talked about your book, Confederate Women, but how, again, did you come to choose Pelican to publish your two books we're talking about, and in particular this new one, The Immortal Captives?
They have always had a really good selection of Civil War titles, and they've always been very regional. Most of their books have to do with the Southern story, and that's really why it was just a good fit.
Well, it definitely is. Now, can we let the cat out of the bag? Is there some new project that's maybe already in the works from Muriel Jocelyn?
Oh, I wish, but I'm afraid I'm in between things right now. I'm teaching school and trying to decide what the next project is, but I usually find the projects find me.
Oh, well,
so
good.
I'm just waiting for it to come along.
Well, we certainly hope that you'll keep us in mind when the next one comes out, because this book and Confederate Women 2 have both been tremendous works. But I have to again say this has been one of the most interesting and enjoyable reads that I've had in a long time, Muriel. And I assure you, the folks at Pelican keep me very busy reading all the time.
I'll bet they do.
Well, folks, we've been talking to Muriel Phillips Jocelyn, who is the author of a brand new book from Pelican entitled Immortal Captives, the story of the 600 Confederate officers and the U.S. POW policy, how they used them for human shields. There during the siege of Charleston. It's a remarkable book. It definitely is a book that you would find interesting. You can take a look at this book by going to the Pelican website at epelican.com and click on the browse feature and type in the title of the book there, Immortal Captives. You can read a review of the book online there, and you can actually purchase it at a reduced price from the Pelican website. But if you're just too anxious, you just have to have it now, well, you can drive down to your local major bookseller, and they probably have a copy of it sitting on the shelf already. If they don't, they can have it to you in about 2 days' time. So the title again, Immortal Captives by Muriel Phillips Jocelyn. And Muriel, we want to thank you again for taking time to be on the program with us this morning, even after finishing up a history class.
Well, that's great. Anytime. I love it.
All right. Well, folks, that's going to do it for this Pelican Pages segment. We've got Ron Wilson's Straight Talk program coming up in just a couple of minutes, so don't go anywhere. There's plenty more great programming from Dixie Broadcasting all day long.